but his fighting hand was burned when he came to his kinsman's aid. He lunged at the enemy lower down, so that his decorated sword sank into its belly, and the flames grew weaker. Once again, the king gathered his strength, and drew a stabbing knife he carried on his belt, sharpened for battle. He stuck it deep into the dragon's flank. Beowulf dealt it a deadly wound. They had killed the enemy. Courage quelled his life. That pair of kinsmen, partners in nobility, had destroyed the foe. So every man should act, be at hand when needed. But now, for the king, this would be the last of his many labors and triumphs in the world. Then, the wound dealt by the ground burner earlier began to scald and swell. Beowulf discovered deadly poison suppurating inside him, surges of nausea, and so, in his wisdom, the prince realized his state and struggled towards a seat on the rampart. He steadied his gaze on those gigantic stones, saw how the earthwork was braced with arches built over columns. And now that thane, unequaled for goodness, with his own hands washed his lord's wounds, swabbed the weary prince with water, bathed him clean, unbuckled his helmet. Beowulf spoke. In spite of his wounds, mortal wounds, he still spoke, for he well knew his days in the world had been lived out to the end. His allotted time was drawing to a close. Death was very near. "Now is the time when I would have wanted to bestow this armor on my own son. Had it been my fortune to have fathered an heir and live on in his flesh. For 50 years I ruled this nation. No king of any neighboring clan would dare face me with troops. None had the power to intimidate me. I took what came, cared for and stood by things in my keeping, never fomented quarrels, never swore to a lie. All this consoles me, doomed as I am and sickening for death. Because of my right ways, the ruler of mankind need never blame me when the breath leaves my body for murder of kinsmen. Go now quickly, dearest Wiglaf, under the grey stone where the dragon is laid out, lost to his treasure. Hurry to feast your eyes on the hoard. Away you go. I want to examine that ancient gold, gaze my fill on those garnered jewels. My going will be easier for having seen the treasure. A less troubled letting go of the life and lordship I have long maintained." And so, I have heard, the son of Wechstan quickly obeyed the command of his languishing, war-weary lord. He went in his chainmail under the rock-piled roof of the barrow, exulting in his triumph, and saw beyond the seat a treasure trove of astonishing richness, wall hangings that were a wonder to behold, glittering gold spread across the ground, the old dawn-scorching serpent's den packed with goblets and vessels from the past, tarnished and corroding, rusty helmets all eaten away, armbands everywhere artfully wrought. How easily treasure buried in the ground, gold hidden however skillfully, can escape from any man. And he saw, too, a standard entirely of gold hanging high over the hoard, a masterpiece of filigree. It glowed with light so he could make out the ground at his feet and inspect the valuables. Of the dragon there was no remaining sign. the sword had dispatched him. Then, the story goes, a certain man plundered the hoard in that immemorial how, filled his arms with flagons and plates, anything he wanted, and took the standard also, most brilliant of banners. Already the blade of the old king's sharp-killing sword had done its worst. The one who had for long minded the hoard, hovering over gold, unleashing fire, surging forth midnight after midnight, had been mown down. Wiglaf went quickly, keen to get back, excited by the treasure. Anxiety weighed on his brave heart. He was hoping he would find the leader of the Geats alive, where he had left him helpless earlier on the open ground. So he came to the place, carrying the treasure, and found his lord bleeding profusely, his life at an end. Again he began to swab his body. The beginnings of an utterance broke out from the king's breast cage. The old lord gazed sadly at the gold. "To the everlasting Lord of all, to the King of Glory I give thanks that I behold this treasure here in front of me, that I have been allowed to leave my people so well endowed on the day I die. Now that I have bartered my last breath to own this fortune, it is up to you to look after their needs. I can hold out no longer. Order my troop to construct a barrow on a headland on the coast after my pyre has cooled. It will loom on the horizon at Hronesness and be a reminder among my people, so that in coming times crews under sail will call it Beowulf's Barrow, as they steer ships across the wide and shrouded waters." Then the king, in his great-heartedness, unclasped the collar of gold from his neck and gave it to the young thane, telling him to use it and the war-shirt and the gilded helmet well. "You are the last of us, the only one left of the Waymundings. Fate swept us away, sent my whole brave, high-born clan to their final doom. Now I must follow them." That was the warrior's last word. He had no more to confide. The furious heat of the pyre would assail him. His soul fled from his breast to its destined place among the steadfast ones. It was hard then on the young hero, having to watch the one he held so dear there on the ground, going through his death agony. The dragon from under earth, his nightmarish destroyer, lay destroyed as well, utterly without life. No longer would his snake folds ply themselves to safeguard hidden gold. Hard-edged blades, hammered out and keenly filed, had finished him, so that the sky-roamer lay there, rigid, brought low beside the treasure lodge. Never again would he glitter and glide, and show himself off in midnight air, exulting in his riches. He fell to earth through the battle strength in Beowulf's arm. There were few indeed, as far as I have heard, big and brave as they may have been, few who would have held out if they had had to face the outpourings of that poison breather, or gone foraging on the ring hall floor and found the deep barrow dweller on guard and awake. The treasure had been won, bought and paid for, by Beowulf's death. Both had reached the end of the road through the life they had been lent. Before long, the battle dodgers abandoned the wood, the ones who had let down their lord earlier, the tail turners, 10 of them together. When he needed them most, they had made off. Now they were ashamed and came behind shields in their battle outfits to where the old man lay. They watched Wiglaf, sitting worn out, a comrade shoulder to shoulder with his lord, trying in vain to bring him round with water. Much as he wanted to, there was no way he could preserve his lord's life on earth, or alter in the least the Almighty's will. What God judged right would rule what happened to every man, as it does to this day. Then a stern rebuke was bound to come from the young warrior to the ones who had been cowards. Wiglaf, son of Wechstan, spoke disdainfully and in disappointment. Anyone ready to admit the truth will surely realize that the Lord of Men who showered you with gifts and gave you the armor you are standing in, when he would distribute helmets and mail shirts to men on the mead benches, a prince treating his thanes in hall to the best he could find far or near, was throwing weapons uselessly away. It would be a sad waste when the war broke out. Beowulf had little cause to brag about his armed guard, yet God, who ordains, who wins or loses, allowed him to strike with his own blade when bravery was needed. There was little I could do to protect his life in the heat of the fray, yet I found new strength welling up when I went to help him. Then my sword connected, and the deadly assaults of our foe grew weaker, the fire coursed less strongly from his head. But when the worst happened, too few rallied around the prince. So it is goodbye now to all you know and love on your home ground. The open-handedness, the giving of war swords. Every one of you with freeholds of land, our whole nation, will be dispossessed. Once princes from beyond get tidings of how you turned and fled and disgraced yourselves. A warrior will sooner die than live a life of shame. Then he ordered the outcome of the fight to be reported to those camped on the ridge, that crowd of retainers who had sat all morning, sad at heart, shield-bearers wondering about the man they loved. Would this day be his last, or would he return? He told the truth and did not balk, the rider who bore news to the clifftop. He addressed them all. Now the people's pride and love, the Lord of the Geats, is laid on his deathbed, brought down by the dragon's attack. Beside him lies the bane of his life, dead from knife wounds. There was no way Beowulf could manage to get the better of the monster with his sword. Wiglaf sits at Beowulf's side, the son of Wechstan, the living warrior, watching by the dead, keeping weary vigil, holding awake for the loved and the loathed. Now, war is looming over our nation. Soon it will be known to Franks and Frisians far and wide that the king is gone. Hostility has been great among the Franks since Hygelac sailed forth at the head of a war fleet into Friesland. There the Hetwara harried and attacked and overwhelmed him with great odds. The leader in his war gear was laid low, fell amongst followers. That lord did not favor his company with spoils. The Merovingian king has been an enemy to us ever since. Nor do I expect peace or pact-keeping of any sort from the Swedes. Remember, at Ravenswood, Ongentheow slaughtered Hathkin, Hrethel's son, when the Geat people in their arrogance first attacked the fierce Silfings. The return blow was quickly struck by Ohtere's father. Old and terrible, he felled the Sea King and saved his own aged wife, the mother of Onela and of Ohtere, bereft of her gold rings. Then he kept hard on the heels of the foe and drove them, leaderless, lucky to get away, in a desperate rout into Ravenswood. His army surrounded the weary remnant where they nursed their wounds. All through the night he howled threats at those huddled survivors, promised to axe their bodies open when dawn broke, dangle them from gallows to feed the birds. But at first light, when their spirits were lowest, relief arrived. They heard the sound of Hygelac's horn, his trumpet calling as he came to find them, the hero in pursuit, at hand with troops. The bloody swath that Swedes and Geats cut through each other was everywhere. No one could miss their murderous feuding. Then the old man made his move, pulled back, barred his people in. Ongentheow withdrew to higher ground. Hygelac's pride and prowess as a fighter were known to the earl. He had no confidence that he could hold out against that horde of seamen, defend wife and the ones he loved from the shock of the attack. He retreated for shelter behind the earth wall. Then Hygelac swooped on the Swedes at bay. His banners swarmed into their refuge. His Geat forces drove forward to destroy the camp. There in his gray hairs, Ongentheow was cornered, ringed around with swords. And it came to pass that the king's fate was in Eivor's hands and in his alone. Wolf, son of Onered, went for him in anger, split him open, so that blood came spurting from under his hair. The old hero still did not flinch, but parried fast, hit back with a harder stroke. The king turned and took him on. Then Onered's son, the brave Wolf, could land no blow against the aged lord. Ongentheow divided his helmet so that he buckled and bowed his bloodied head and dropped to the ground. But his doom held off. Though he was cut deep, he recovered again. With his brother down, the undaunted Eivor, Hygelac's thane, hefted his sword and smashed murderously at the massive helmet past the lifted shield. And the king collapsed. The shepherd of people was sheared of life. Many then hurried to help Wolf, bandaged and lifted him now that they were left masters of the blood-soaked battleground. One warrior stripped the other, looted Ongentheow's iron mail coat, his hard sword hilt, his helmet too, and carried the graith to King Hygelac. He accepted the prize, promised fairly that reward would come, and kept his word. For their bravery in action, when they arrived home, Eivor and Wolf were overloaded by Hrethel's son, Hygelac the Geat, with gifts of land and linked rings that were worth a fortune. They had won glory, so there was no gainsaying his generosity. And he gave Eivor his only daughter to bide at home with him, an honor and a bond. So, this bad blood between us and the Swedes, this vicious feud, I am convinced, is bound to revive. They will cross our borders and attack in force when they find out that Beowulf is dead. In days gone by, when our warriors fell and we were undefended, he kept our coffers and our kingdom safe. He worked for the people, but as well as that, he behaved like a hero. We must hurry now to take a last look at the king, and launch him, lord and lavisher of rings, on the funeral road. His royal pyre will melt no small amount of gold. Heaped there in a hoard, it was bought at heavy cost. And that pile of rings he paid for at the end with his own life will go up with the flame, be furled in fire. Treasure no follower will wear in his memory, nor lovely woman link and attach as a torque around her neck. But often, repeatedly, in the path of exile, they shall walk bereft, bowed under woe, now that their leader's laugh is silenced, high spirits quenched. Many a spear, dawn cold to the touch, will be taken down and waved on high. The swept harp won't waken warriors, but the raven, winging darkly over the doomed, will have news, tidings for the eagle of how he hoked and ate, how the wolf and he made